Jesus, please don't be mad. I know that it makes you sad when I simply don't.
Welcome to Face of Appalachia, stories of hidden values, hidden faith. I'm Rob Music. I'm a chaplain and priest, and we dive in this podcast to average stories of average people from central Appalachia, because we have this understanding that many people look at Appalachia as a monocultural, kind of everyone's exactly the same. And my experience with people is that we have these incredible, beautiful stories of faith and non-faith in our region that we want to lift up. We want to give a special thanks to our grant sponsors, the National Endowment for the Arts and for Humanities, and Kentucky Humanities for their generous gift. And today I am really honored, because we're going to get really personal today. We're going to talk to my priest, Judy. And would you introduce yourself? Who are you?
That's a good question. First of all, I'm a member of a monastic community. I've been a professed religious for 65 years. And I'm also an Episcopal priest and was pastor here at St. James for a number of years, and now I'm retired. I'm still an active priest, but I'm retired. And I came to Appalachia.
Well, I'm going to pause you right there for a second, because you just retired.
Yeah.
I mean, we're within what, maybe just 6 months of you retiring.
That's right.
And not to ask too personal, but what is your age?
My age is 84.
84, okay. So make sure that everyone knows that you have been working hard for the Lord for a really long time. And
I was too old for the church insurance to take me as one of their people, because they didn't think I'd last that long.
Joke's on them. You keep going.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Well,
that's
you right. Said that, you know, you are professed religious.
Yes.
Right, that could be a different term for lots of people. What does that mean, professed religious?
In the monastic life, whether you're in an ecumenical community which accepts people from all faiths, or whether you're a member of the Catholic Church or any other Christian religious order, you make a commitment. And your commitment is for the obedience to the rule and to a superior, and to contribute to the well-being of the whole group.
Okay, so you really, I mean, when we think professed religious, we think nuns, priests,
yes,
deacons,
yes.
Those types of, okay. So you have been in that professed community for 65 years.
That's correct.
So you were really young when you decided to become.
Well, I had finished high school and entered the monastic community at Ferdinand, Indiana, right after high school.
Okay. So when that happens, I mean, did the skies open up and you heard this audible voice that said, Judy, be a nun? Or how did it work for you to kind of say, I want to, because this is a unique call, right? There's very few people jumping into it now. How did you get there to know that was it for you?
Well, I went to the boarding school there primarily because at the local high school, girls didn't get to do anything. They couldn't. This was in the 50s, so you couldn't be play in the band. You couldn't play sports. You couldn't play any of that in the 50s if you were a woman. So I said to my dad, I want to go someplace because I play the clarinet, and I want to go someplace where I can play music and I can be in sports, and I can't do that at the local Catholic high school in the 50s. So then I went to the boarding school, and I saw that the people that were entering the community there were happy, you know, were fulfilled. And so that's what I felt God was calling me to. And it wasn't long before, after I made profession and I was out teaching, that I felt a call to missionary life. And so I was a missionary, a Catholic missionary, a Benedictine sister in Guatemala. Mm. And then I went from Guatemala to Peru. And from Peru, I came back to the States. And I began giving retreats to various denominations. And finally, I was giving a retreat to a group of Lutherans from Richmond. And the one person said to me, "Sister, when are you going to realize that you really are an Episcopalian? Because your beliefs and the Catholic Church's beliefs are kind of don't go aside." And I said to myself, "You know, I'm tired of being angry."
Wow.
I'm just like I was tired of going to a high school that wouldn't let women do anything. I was at that same place. And so I chose to join the Episcopal Church. So I was tired of being angry.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing that after all those years, so, I mean, and to choosing to just to honor what's going on inside of you as opposed to kind of continuing to be put in a container. You want to, so, you know, you receive this, you know, you join a community, I mean, you join the religious life, you become a school teacher, right?
Right.
What grades were you teaching?
It's strange. I started out teaching second grade.
Oh, okay.
And I sometimes fell asleep while they were reading. So, and the next year, they transferred me to high school, and I taught algebra and business math. So I went from one to the other.
Wow, so you were teaching high school. And then, so tell me more about this mission call. You sensed the call to kind of be a missionary.
Because the community was opening a mission in Guatemala.
Okay, so your religious community was opening. And then when they open that, do they send out a message saying, we're calling sisters to come, or?
I guess a community meeting, they just said we had a request from this bishop in Guatemala for to start a community there, and if there are people that would like to go and feel called, then let us know. So I let them know.
Wow. Okay. Now, you know, often as people talk about a call, they will say that they were like wrestling with it, and they're like, "Oh, maybe this is. Hopefully, God, this is not it." Was your call anything like that, or was it more like a natural fit? Or
it was a natural fit, I think. But I don't know why. But it was. It was exciting. I feel that I have had a very exciting life.
I would agree. You had an exciting life. So you go from when you became a nun, you were in Indiana.
Yeah.
And then you went from Indiana to Guatemala.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
And from Guatemala to Peru, and from Peru back to Indiana, and at that time, they were starting a mission in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
So Sister Eileen and I came to the mountains in 1978.
Wow. So when you were in Guatemala, I'm imagining that's a pretty big cultural shift. I mean, your life had been in Indiana, and then you end up in Guatemala. Was it hard to adjust there to Guatemala?
Well, I had to learn Spanish. And, the first year I taught in a boys' colegio,
okay.
Boys' high school, I could talk about Jesus very nicely in Spanish, but after you asked where the bathroom was, that was kind of the end of my Spanish. So I quickly, to survive, had to learn a little bit more Spanish.
Okay.
And in Guatemala, we worked with the Benedictine Fathers from Blue Cloud Abbey and North Dakota. And then when I went to Peru, they opened a mission in Peru, and so they wanted some of us from Guatemala to go to Peru, which I did, and there we work with the Augustinian priest from Chicago. And again, I was fortunate because they hired me to teach in this high school, which was a public high school in Santo Domingo in Peru. They needed someone to teach music and art history.
Oh.
Which they had in their curriculum, which we don't in the States. And I had, in the meantime, when I was teaching in the States, I got a bachelor's in education, but I have a master's in humanities.
Okay.
So some of my humanities classes were considered by the bishop to count for my priest ordination.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when you're doing Guatemala and Peru, you have a call to be a missionary. Did you suspect at that point that life would be kind of living in another culture the rest of your life?
I don't know. I don't know in those days that you thought that far ahead.
Oh, okay.
You know, I think you're fully occupied in there in teaching high school, and in Guatemala you might have high school students who are 21 years old, because it took them that long to reach the point. They probably had to walk miles to get to the school.
Okay.
So if you think, well, I'll be teaching freshmen in high school, high school age that I had taught at Modern Day in Evansville before I went to Guatemala. No, these were adult men. So to keep ahead of them, I really had to prepare my lesson. And if I stopped, they'd take over the classroom.
Yeah, because they're adult men, yeah.
Yeah. So I was totally focused on preparing my lesson, learning more Spanish so I would understand what they were talking about. And it's so interesting what you come upon. So I went to a diocesan convention, huh? And this theologian from France was teaching.
Mm.
And he kept using the word chos, chos, chos. And I said to one of the other Guatemalan sisters, I said, "What's chos? Must be important because he keeps using it." She said, "Oh, that's a Frenchman trying to say Dios." Dios is God. Said, yeah, it's kind of important. So here all along, I thought he was talking about Jos.
But anyway. He changes everything when he starts talking about God.
Yeah.
So you were, you're kind of, not thinking that far ahead. You're just doing, you're being obedient. You're just like following the Lord. You're teaching school, trying to make sure you're ahead of these guys who are in your classes. And then you return back to the United States. And how long was it from returning back to the States did you respond to that first bishop's appeal for the first letter from Appalachia to respond to come?
It wasn't very long, because I guess I got used to living in the mountains. See, I lived in the mountains both in Guatemala and in Peru.
Yeah, so this feels kind of home.
So it was home to come into Appalachia. They offered us, there was a retreat center in, I think, Charleston. And they said, it's a big facility. And Eileen and I said, big facility, that's not us.
Okay.
So we came into the area here, and we were looking to buy property, but no. In those days in 78, they were no property was handed down to family. They never hardly ever put it on the market.
Gotcha.
So we found a place that at Blue River that we could become part of a co-op.
Oh, okay.
And so we had a house there.
So yeah, so the bishops write this letter to kind of appeal for people to kind of focus in on Appalachia. And part of that was that there needed to be, spiritual places for people to do retreat.
That's right.
To recharge. Centers of prayer and reflection.
Yeah.
So you guys responded to that.
Yeah.
And came and have built a beautiful, great community.
Well, the Lord takes care of us.
So how have you, so you start with a call, or you start with a response to a letter. You come, you start setting up shop. And And I know we could fill this entire time with ways that you've seen God kind of provide, but can you think of a couple ways of how you saw God respond in those years?
Well, the first was that we were able to get, Eileen and I both had jobs in the public school.
Okay.
So, because we had to pay our bills, and you can't have a retreat center if you don't pay your bills.
A very primitive retreat center with no electricity.
Yeah. No, so that's what we did. I taught at Home Branch, which was it was an old church. So in one part of the church, there were two little buildings next to each other. Were grades 1 through 4, and I had grades 5 through 8 in one room.
Oh, okay. So you literally were teaching almost in a one-room schoolhouse.
Yeah, and that was great because these children had a teacher who was going blind, so they were bored.
Oh,
so
okay.
I provided them, because of my background, I was able to provide them with a love of poetry, those were the days here in Floyd County where to discipline the children, everybody carried a paddle.
Oh, okay.
And so for Christmas, they gave me a paddle with all of their names signed on it. And I hung it on a wall. But we had a really nice, because they would, if say I was having fifth grade reading. Well, whoever came next, like the seventh grade reading, they would go up to my desk, get my lesson plan book. The sixth grade would leave. They'd slide the lesson plan book in front of me, and I'd go on with the lesson. So it was just a lot of fun. And I enjoyed them, and I think they enjoyed me. And I'm still having problems now with my Social Security because when I went to retire, I couldn't give an account for a couple of years. And this gentleman said, oh, I know where you were. You taught me. That's where you were. You taught me. I was in the sixth grade. And so they called me Sister Jay. And so now I'm still struggling to get the government to say that Sister J. Yunker is Judy Yunker.
Okay, so you're still fighting that battle.
I'm still fighting that battle, but it was, I'm a creative person, so being creative, you can do it in many ways.
That, I'm so glad you said that. I think that is one of the things that's really stood out to me about your journey has been you're just really creative and not taking no for an answer, but just like quietly pushing and quietly doing. And so you guys come, you and Eileen come, you set up. And then how long, when you created Mount Tabor, this beautiful Benedictine or ecumenical community now, how did you guys start that?
Well, at that time, I was working with Father Biding, starting Mountain Christian Academy, where that was there in Martin. And the property at Blue River was sold.
Oh.
So we had to move. And so we wanted to rent someplace, but this place became for sale, and so Father Biding helped us find it. And the clue was it had burned down, and the house had burned down, and the only thing that was left was the chimney. And so Father Biding rented a dozer, and one of his folks from Christian Appalachia Project, which he had started a branch in eastern Kentucky, because they had started in Somerset
okay.
over that way. So he said to Mike Sanders, he said, Mike, take that dozer and shove that chimney over. And Mike said, how do I know it's not going to go on me? He said, have faith. So Mike climbed on the dozer and he pushed the chimney over. And that we cleared off that pad.
Okay.
And we used the concrete pad And then we put all the plumbing and pipes back of it.
Okay.
And send, so then years later, we had somebody build the what is now a kind of a brick wall in the back so that you can walk around the whole thing.
Ah. So you really, I mean, you really kind of start with a concrete pad.
That's right.
To build a chapel, living quarters, retreat house, private retreat house.
Well, see, we little by little. See, once we were on the there on that one level, then we went up the hill and to the left, and that's where we Father Biding helped us carve out that space for the chapel. And then the bedroom building, and then eventually the monastery part.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're working with Father Biding, you're building this community, and but now you have, what, seven professed sisters who live with you?
Seven professed sisters, and one, we call her cluster oblate that lives with us.
Yeah, okay.
And... So we're eight.
Wow, and when at your biggest, how many sisters were living there at one point?
Not more than 10 or 11.
I was saying, you hadn't been too big,
no.
But enough to share. And then you know you are a Benedictine sister, right? You live your life according to the rule.
That's right.
For a lot of people, they have no idea what the rule of Saint Benedict is. And we talk about rule, they're imagining these like rando Catholic things that they've only heard about on the internet. What's it mean to live your life according to the rule?
Well, you know the rule, and each of the chapters have always been interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
So you. Like, we read from the rule each night at supper. So it talks about people living together and how can you live together in peace, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all these from very specific instructions. So for all these years, you've been trying to shape your life around, of course, the gospel, but then the rule. And because you live in a really unique setting, most of us don't live in religious community. Right, we have to fight with our kids or something, but you're living with sisters. I mean, what's it like to live in a religious community?
It's like a family. And my parents were oblates. So I grew up listening over the railing to a Benedictine priest talking to this group of men and women, families, about the rule of Benedict and how that can affect their life as a family.
Mm.
So I grew up listening to my parents pray Compline on their knees by the bed. So that's the introduction I had.
Wow. So I mean, it's in your DNA.
Yeah, I think so.
That's incredible. So living these years in religious community according to the rule, and but you shared with us, you know, it wasn't like the Episcopal Church came on a secret retreat and snagged you and said, oh, here's this great sister we want to make an Episcopalian. It was Lutherans, right? So,
yeah.
But I suspect that, maybe I'm wrong, but I suspect it wasn't like, oh, you'd never thought about that. That was the first time, and now you're going to just jump right in and leave everything that you had, you know. What was the process like of discerning leaving being a kind of a Catholic nun to being an Episcopalian priest?
Well, in the meantime, we had become an ecumenical community.
Okay.
Saying, and we're still members of the Federation, but they have two communities who are members who are ecumenical. And so what when I was giving that retreat to the Lutherans, what in my own sharing, what they reflected to me is that when are you going to admit that if someone who is a Presbyterian can enter to join that ecumenical community, then you can leave the Catholic Church and join the Episcopal Church and still be a member of the community. See, okay. I never thought of it. I just thought the other way, you know. And I could feel myself getting angry with the way the church was and still does treat women. And so I must have shared enough of that with this Lutheran group that they said, when are you going to admit that if someone can come in, someone can go out and still be a member of the ecumenical community?
Gotcha. So really, it was the community that you live with when they decided to become ecumenical. That's really when the doors kind of started opening, right?
That's right.
And you guys as a community moved from being Catholic to ecumenical. And what was the reasoning behind that?
We had, both Eileen and I had taught at Mountain Christian Academy, mm-hmm. which was ecumenical.
Okay.
So our occupation that we had here in Eastern Kentucky, Floyd County, was that of shared faith.
Yeah, right. So that's just a part of your ethos is shared faith, and as you're sharing, so you know the door is open that you could stay in your community and not be a Catholic, be something else. So you know, but it's a big change from being a priest.
Yeah, and see, again, it was a pastoral letter from Bishop Sauls to the Episcopal Church in Eastern Kentucky that there should be called forth within this group of Episcopalians some ministers to come forth. And so it was the decision for me was to whether to stay a deacon mm-hmm. or to go on and become a priest.
Yeah.
That was the hard decision.
Oh, okay.
Because the deacons were the ones that were the outward ministering to mm-hmm. the people. And that's what I wanted. But my spiritual director reminded me that a creative part of me was the sermon.
Gotcha.
Where I could use my background and my own creativity to bring forth the word.
Yeah, okay.
So finally I made the decision and told the bishop that I wanted to be a transitional deacon.
So at the time of life when you're becoming a deacon, or becoming a deacon and then a priest, I mean, you're early 70s. People are hanging it up. They're buying a sailboat. They are, you know, they're not thinking about a new career. And you just dove right in.
Well, I couldn't help my age. God was calling me, so what can I do? I just have to. The challenge is greater, the invitation is greater than the hang-ups.
That's an incredible line. The challenge is greater than the hang-ups. The invitation is greater than the hang-ups. That's an incredible line. And you've wrestled with, and you've battled with cancer during this time. And so, I mean, as a lifelong Catholic, you know, when there are clear, like every priest you've ever seen has been a man. That's how it works, right? Every bishop you've ever seen in the Catholic Church is a man, right? And when you became a priest and celebrated the Eucharist, what was it like to celebrate the Eucharist the first time, you as the officiant, you as the presider?
Fantastic. Humbling, but fantastic.
And was that something that it felt like, wow, this really could have been something that for a long time in my life. Okay.
Yeah. I guess it should be that the greatest event in my life would be when I made the religious profession. But as I look back on it, the time when I felt the most important moment in my life was in the ordination process when all the priests put their hands on the shoulder.
Wow.
That for me was the most important moment in my life.
That's powerful. In that moment when everyone's putting their hands on you, and what did that mean for you?
The beauty of God, fulfillment, and humility. It humbled me that my journey had been exciting.
It definitely has been exciting. I mean, in you, from Sister Jay, the teacher, to Sister Judy, to Reverend Judy, to that Episcopal priest, all these different ways that people know you in the community. I mean, you have been a pioneer, right? I mean, and I know you probably don't feel that way, right? Because that's not part of the vibe. But you've, as an onlooker, you've been a pioneer here, making space for all kinds of other people. And when you guys had your church building, right there at the foot of a community college, Big Sandy Community Technical College, which now is just a grassy spot, but you used to have a beautiful church there. And when you all put out a rainbow pew, I don't mean inside the church. Y'all had the rainbow pew outside the church in more conservative Floyd County. What was that like to make that kind of statement?
At that time, it was because there had been problems. The church, Episcopal Church, didn't have, especially that one there on the corner, didn't have a very good opinion in the church in Floyd County. So I worked very hard, and we're going through their pictures that Denise and I have found in scrapbooks of when Phil and Ron Rohr joined the church. And that reminded me that it's very easy, I think, to say, here we are, Prestonsburg, we're not like we used to be. But through service in the food pantry, we have been able to change the opinion of Floyd County, most people, and know that we are serving, and that we are a serving church. And now as we this mount of stuff back here.
Yeah, people can't see it, but we're surrounded by all, it looks like a garage sale gone wild behind us, and all the stuff that the food pantry has just moved to its new home at the United Methodist Church. So
that's right, and we're happy that they have welcomed us, and most of this stuff needs to disappear because it has lived many lives in many places. And you don't tend to clean, like where we're moving from, you don't tend to clean out what people have given you. So, I mean, you know, we look over there and that there's 10 rolls of paper towels, and there's 10 rolls of paper towels below that. So, you know, you think, well, we might need paper towels. And so I'm sure that probably not today, because everybody, all the volunteers are tired and Derek here had bruises from you know, and Pat. But tomorrow, they'll go back to and try to get rid of this stuff that's there.
Yeah.
That we've carried from place to place, and we don't need to carry it anymore.
Yeah, I think that's one of the creative pieces, right? So, you know, you become this priest, you have a rainbow pew out there, you're trying to make a statement to the community that you are an inclusive, open community. You're not what y'all used to be or what they used to be. So Ron and Phil come in, you know, Ron becomes a deacon. They're a married, two men who are married. Way before that was the cool, hip thing to do in rural eastern Kentucky. So here you are. You have a priest who's 70 or above, who's a female in a very male-dominated clergy. I'm sure you were the only female probably around at that point, right?
Yeah, graciously, I don't think Ron and Phil were ever married because of Ron's illness.
Oh,
see,
yeah.
Medically, it couldn't happen.
Sure, okay.
But they were members of the church and worked very hard, and Ron Rohr was always the crucifer.
Mm-hmm, okay.
So that's what we buried him in.
Yeah, okay, I remember.
And when this current bishop said, for an ordination, you should come with a cassock and a surplice, I said, my friend Keela, who's a Episcopal priest, I said, Keela, we buried Ron in my cassock. I said, besides, I don't fit in a 17-year-old's cassock anymore. It just isn't possible. So I started wearing just an alb, and now they've come around. Enough priests have said, we don't want to do this. We just want to wear the alb and the stole and be done with it. So for your ordination, that's what we wore.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So you guys had this trend-setting small church where you're really including anybody. You know, you sell your building, and then you guys start moving to various different places. At one point, we were just reminiscing today that you guys were having service in a Southern Baptist church.
That's right, that's right. Bobby Carpenter was the emergency management regional coordinator. And so by that time, he was living in Frankfort. And he would come down on a Sunday because he was still pastor there. Mm-hmm. And I had been on the rescue squad for like 10 years.
Okay.
As dispatch and chaplain. And I had a service dog who was also a comfort dog, because when there's a terrible drowning or accident or anything like that, there's family to be consoled and there's witnesses to be consoled. So a service dog who's also a comfort dog, which she is too, people are calmed by petting. Mm. And so that's what I would do. I would go to say a drowning here at Jenny Wiley, and as they were, there is a method by which you search for drowning victims, and it's a grid pattern.
Mm.
And there's somebody on the shore directing the grid, and when they locate the body, everybody in the boat takes off their hat, and that's a sign to the chaplain. And the family doesn't realize
that. Yeah, they don't know what's going on.
That the body has been located.
Wow.
So it's a very respectful, a very prayerful kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I was chaplain there. I just resigned after I began to work toward being ordained a priest. Because I knew that the pantry was taking off, and I could no longer get up in the middle of the night to respond to a call.
Sure.
And drive, you know, up to Mud Creek, and by the time I got there, the only thing they said, Judy, you go down and direct the traffic so the ambulance can get out of here. So I didn't get up in the middle of the night.
Yeah, anymore.
Anymore.
So you, you know, you lead this community of an eclectic group of people, but small, right? We're never talking about 100 people, you know, always a small community. You guys start a food pantry that's feeding now over 100 people a week. You've been in various different places, been a pioneer for, you know, queer rights and queer identity. And when you did that, I mean, you said, you know, you were saying you wanted the church to have a better reputation in town, right? There's all kinds of things you all could have done. A rainbow pew is kind of an intentional, like, what made you decide, like, that was the kind of forward-facing thing that you wanted to do in community?
I don't know. It just seemed natural. And what we would do is if some woman, at first they would always call me.
Okay.
If somebody wanted a marriage license. And I would say, well, I will marry you if you go through this prematrimonial. And so that two of my folks who were lesbian and gay, they would hold the same kind of marriage preparation that you would for an ordinary couple. So many times, of course, nobody wanted to do that. But, you know, what we believe, and it was easier for people who had already lived together for 27 years or something like that. There was no doubt in their minds that they were going to be faithful. And so I did quite a few.
It's incredible. So you're making space for so many people to even if they weren't coming to St. James, they felt like there at least was a space they could come to. And the incredible, this is way before Pride festivals and anything like that in Eastern Kentucky. You guys are just carving a path. And now as you've, you know, served all these years in these various different ways, but always this, whether it's an ecumenical community or 21-year-olds who are in high school classes, your whole life you've creatively been making space for people who maybe don't fit in spaces, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm struck by how you as a very young woman just longing to be in band and having leadership roles and not having given those access, that you've kind of had to carve a path to do that. So, you know, as we're thinking about wrapping up, I'm wondering now here at 84 with all the life and all the stories and all the things, you know, how Yoast has provided for you, right? How God has provided for you. If you were to go back and meet your 20-year-old self or your 18-year-old self, what kind of advice would you have for that young woman?
Don't give up, because you can do whatever you feel like you can do. Just don't give up. Find a way to fulfill your dream.
It's a really good word. Don't give up. Just keep pressing. Keep going. There will be a way. Well, I am really honored to be one of your faithful as my priest over these many years, and now to get to share the same pulpit as you, even though the pulpit has changed and moved and taken on very different shapes depending on where we're at the time. It's just really a blessing. So anything else as we close, anything else you want people to know when they think of your journey or you?
I don't like being bored. And if you're a person that likes doing the same thing over and over again, well, that's not who I am. And so if you're creative, follow your dream. It may not be that anybody else has been there before, but follow it.
That's incredible advice, because you think about, I'm just struck by that.
You know, you don't want to be bored, and you're highly creative. And what people think about with the stereotypes of, like, nuns is, like, y'all do the same thing every day, you know, praying, chanting some random thing, right, in Latin, and it's just this very bored. Because if you think, if I were to talk to some young people now and say, do you want to join religious life, they would say, oh, my gosh, that is so terrible and so boring. And your life has been the opposite of boring from, you know, all the things you guys have accomplished in your lives, the various people, to even one time hearing about you guys having a sheep and trying to put it at a car wash and all kinds
of... Yeah, we did. They took her down and they got her off, but after they soaped her down, she wouldn't get back up and she was too heavy. So some other guys came and were washing their cars and they said, can you help us put this sheep back into the truck? And they said, sure.
I think that is an apt metaphor for your journey, including people who are going to get you all wet and, you know, all kinds of things, but trying to make space even for the soaked down sheep. So, Reverend Judy, thank you for your time. Thanks for being a guest on our podcast.
You're welcome.
I know that it makes you sad when I simply don't obey.